Blow the horn, let's go.
Everything that we do every day, we want to be a champion.
Get your mind right and let's go. Do the little things. Win every day.
It's the sole place they play football.
Everything with an attitude.
Alabama, you listen.
Keith fumbled and Alabama has recovered.
I told you what they were going to do.
Touchdown, Alabama.
It's 13 national championships.
Roll Tide!
I don't give a shit who we're playing.
Nothing they can play against. And make his ass quit. That's our framework. That's our
MO
with the team.
Daniel Moore, get your canvas ready.
All right.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Yet again, it was a tale of two halves. A boring and lethargic 6-6 game at half blossoms into a 31-0 romp in the second half. The final, 37-6, was fun, but the route was circuitous. Tom, react.
I'm getting a little frustrated that we can't put a full game together. I think Saban said it best after the game. You know, he likes to talk about a prize fight. He likes to talk about, you know, putting them on their back and, you know, getting them up against the rope and dropping them in the first round. And he said, we haven't been put away yet by another team, but we're definitely losing round one. And I guess this, you know, Vandy, we did the same thing. We turn around in Ole Miss and we put a complete game together. Hopefully the way we've been this on again and off again with our first half, hopefully we'll turn it around again for LSU.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, the Vanderbilt, it was homecoming and they had an extra day off. You know, Tennessee, we have a bye week this next week. They very easily could have been looking ahead to the bye, not necessarily looking ahead to LSU, but certainly probably looking ahead to the bye, getting some time off. What's interesting to me, and I'm kind of taking a contrarian view, at least to an extent, how many times have we seen a game start out like this where we've been lethargic, we haven't played our game, and we end up finding that, you know, win or lose, you know, it's an 18-12 kind of game, and we'll either win it or we'll lose it, and it'll be a dog mess kind of game. Not that we always should, but the fact that we can reach down and flip the switch and end up with a dominating performance here in the second half, I mean, that's impressive, at least at some level.
I was surprised that Coach Saban said in his coach's show after the game, he did say he had a tough time to get this team to focus because of what was to lie ahead. And because they had some nagging injuries and they'd been playing 8 weeks in a row. So I was surprised he did at least acknowledge that LSU probably had a little bit to do with it.
I think the bye, you're going 8 weeks straight. There's going to be some exhaustion. And so I think it's a little bit of LSU. I think it's a lot of the bye, you know, compare and contrast a little bit, you know, this year to 09. In 09, we went into the Tennessee game just on fumes and we had to block two field goals to win that game. The fact that we could come out of a 6-6 half and just outscore them, you know, 31-0 in the second half, we're not running on fumes. And I look at is a strange way of measuring it, but man, we're good.
We are. And being able to flip the switch, like you mentioned, I don't remember us ever having the ability to do that before. And it goes also back to, I think, the conditioning that Coach Cochran is doing, the type of players that he's bringing in. I mean, these guys are rock solid specimens. And, you know, I'm just going to use the term warriors because I know people don't like us to refer to it as war, but it is. And these guys, you know, Coach Saban even asked him if he had to peel the paint off the wall in the locker room. And surprisingly, he said no. He said he turned to the players and said, what do you want for the next 30 minutes of this ball game? What do you want for the rest of your season? And I thought it was interesting with the veteran leadership of this team. He just kind of turned to them and said, make this whatever you want for the rest of the game. And they showed what they wanted.
Yeah. Tell me what you saw on offense. What caught your eye on that side of the ball?
This was the first game, I think, that we had to put the game a little bit on the shoulders of AJ. I think to Tennessee's credit, and, you know, I wish they would have never hired Derek Dooley because I think he's a really good coach. This was the best run defense we faced. And other teams have put eight guys in the box, but we've still been able to, you know, get some yards. And they shut our run down early. And for us to come out and really air the ball out and really put them on their heels and stretch that defense, I was glad to see AJ show himself that he can do that and put up close to a 300-yard game before we had to go play LSU.
I agree. I wrote down the emergence of the passing game really as an observation on my side. You know, Tennessee definitely stacked the box, you know, 8 or 9 men in the middle. You know, Tennessee, does they're going to have some quality players, some quality recruits. They play some 46 principals, so they're head up on the center as well as both of the guards, so it's hard to get a double team there. And then they just really stack the line. But really, you know, to your point, we had to rely on the passing game. We've talked at length over the last couple of weeks about the improvement of the passing game, and it just continues to emerge where we really did have to lean on it. And, you know, the result was pretty spectacular. AJ had a career day, almost 300 yards. You know, he was 9 for 11 in the second half where we really came out and said, you know, we're throwing the ball. And he had 162 of his yards in the second half. We had a number of receivers that stepped up and performed well. So I'm pleased that when we had to go to it, we could. And that really bodes well for the rest of the season.
It does. And it was nice to see how he responded after the interception. You know, Phil Savage said in his commentary that it was good to get that out of the way, or good to get past that consecutive streak of 153 passes or whatever it was, and kind of get that monkey off your back. And he really showed some good toughness in responding like he did.
It's a couple things, right? It does become a number and it becomes a record and it becomes something that the media wants to focus on. You can almost kind of run a counter in your head with every pass. I didn't throw a pick. Then you get so absorbed in not throwing a pick that you don't make the play. And so the fact that we're kind of wipe that slate clean, kind of get it out of the way, if you will, that's certainly one thing. But then the fact that he throws the pick and then just kind of shakes it off. He had a moment of adversity there, shook it off, not only him, but the team as well. But he shook it off and had a career day.
No, I agree. What did you think about the play of McCullough stepping in for Steen?
Well, I was very pleased with McCullough stepping in. You know, Steen had suffered concussion-like symptoms the week before. McCullough, he's a senior, he steps in. I didn't sense that we really missed a beat. He's a little bit of a bigger guy.
He's got the versatility like a Barrett Jones, don't you think?
He really does. It turns out that, you know, some of the latest breaking news today, we may need McCullough playing some different positions on the line, and we may need him some at tackle with the latest development with Cyrus Kwanjo.
Right. What else jumped out at you as far as the offense? I mean, they responded really well in the second half. You know, just going back to the first half for a second, you know, we had a couple opportunities where we had first down at the 12-yard line. We had some momentum in that first quarter, and we ended up having to settle for field goals. I was very surprised at some of our play selection when we got down in the red zone in that first half.
Yeah, that was a little frustrating. I wish we just tried to plug the ball a little bit more. And, you know, you have to execute in the red zone, and certainly that's important. It's a compressed field. There's less field for the defense to cover. I think you have to play call correctly and strategically in the same token. And for whatever reason, I hate to use the word struggle, but if there's a flaw in our offensive game or an Achilles heel, really, it's our red zone production.
It is. And what was interesting about that is in the first quarter, you know, we have the big pass to Mays, which we can talk about for a second briefly. And then we get down to the 12-yard line and we pass 3 times and we end up settling for a field goal. The next time we get back down there, we're at the 12-yard line and we run the ball 3 times. And we proceed to have mixed success. It's like we tried all pass, and then we tried all run. And it was like, you know, it was a little bit frustrating because, like you said, it's like we have a full playbook, a full arsenal, if you would, of everything going on between the 20s. And then sometimes when we get inside the 20, we do not anymore.
Yeah, I think we clinch a little bit sometimes in the red zone. I hate to say that we're happy just to get to 3 because I'd like to see us be a little more aggressive. And to your point of striking for the end zone outside of the 20, we seem to have better success doing that than we do sometimes within the 20-yard line.
What else jumped out at you on offense?
Well, I think 3 receivers I thought really jumped out, Mays, Hanks, and Bell. Mays quietly put up 106 yards. 3 circus catches that really bailed us out of situations. Bell had 3 catches as well and then caught his first career touchdown. So I'm pleased with all 3 of those guys. Starts to give us, you factor in Smelly, caught a couple balls as well. We're starting to really have a couple of weapons on offense. And DeAndrew, he's kind of on again, off again. I don't understand the situation with him. He did not catch any balls, but, you know, he's certainly a weapon for us as well.
What do you think about, I mean, once again, we had several wide receivers that stepped up and made plays. I wish I would have seen DeAndre White kind of get in the mix, but, you know, just to touch on Darius Hanks for a minute, you know, early in the season when he had to miss those two ball games, you know, we were talking about his veteran leadership and what he brings to the table. And Coach Saban was talking last week about how hard they work on not only getting off the field on third down on defense, but, you know, converting third downs on offense. And, you know, the commentators were talking about how Alabama keeps upping those percentages of their third down success rate. Well, two big third downs, you know, AJ threw the ball, and I guess he thought Darius Hanks was about 6'7". And he only had three catches for the night, but all three catches were huge, difficult catches that not everybody can make.
Oh, absolutely. All three were circus catches. And so I think there's a correlation. If there's an uptick in our third down conversion rate, I think you could plot that along a similar line to the contribution that we're getting from Hanks.
Anything else on offense as far as anything else that kind of caught your eye?
Yeah, I think just in terms of the right way to come out of half, is really what we did offensively, and we can talk defense as well, but coming out of half, you know, in the third quarter, we scored 21 points. 9 of our first 10 plays in the second half go for first downs, and the 10th play that didn't go for a first down went for a touchdown. I mean, that is prototypical how you respond coming out of half.
It is, and what was surprising is Saban was talking about how he told his coaching staff at halftime, you know, they're stacking the box. We've got to throw the ball. And they really took that for heart, because not only did they convert all of those first downs, you know, in consecutive plays, but they were all passes. I mean, they come out when they get the ball, pass to Richardson, 22 yards, pass to Hanks, 14, pass to Mays for 20, Smelly for 17, and then AJ runs it in from 2 yards out. I mean, literally, we were averaging 20 yards a pass on 4 consecutive plays. I mean, that's just like bam, bam, bam.
Well, we become dangerous when, you know, they stop the run. And if we had, you know, peeled paint in the locker room and came back and said, okay, we're doubling down on the run, and that's just what we're going to do because that's our personality, it's a different ball game altogether. When they bottle us up on the running game and we're able to come back and say, all right, we're going to let it loose and throw the ball, and we're able to do so with such success, that just makes us that much more dangerous.
You know, that's an interesting point real quick, because if we compare back to the 09 team, I don't think the 09 team that had a lot of success running the ball and could really dictate the tempo, I don't think the 09 team could have come out and flipped the switch to passing like that as well as this team did.
No, I don't think so either. You know, it's almost, you know, this will be kind of a cheesy analogy, but it's almost like the Predator when they thought they were going to catch him, and he just, you know, toggled his vision so that he could look through infrared, and then he was just able to perform and able to do what he did. You know, okay, they bottled up Trent, they bottled up the run, and we just kind of toggled how we're going to call plays and perform, and we came out very successfully passing the ball.
We did. And, you know, one other thing on that first drive in the second half that I just want to touch on a second, going back to McCarron, how did you like that play? Kind of break down that play where he did, you know, kind of improvise and get that pass on the sideline to Smelly.
That was a thing of beauty. I mean, he was getting some pressure. He could have run, and I would not have been disappointed. He could have thrown it away, and that could have been a smart play for the quarterback. But he sprinted out and then paused, knowing that, you know, there's a good chance that I'm going to get hit. But he sprinted out, paused, waited for just a little bit of separation for Smelly, and he threw that ball. That's an NFL play. I'm not saying that he played like an NFL quarterback for the duration of the game, but that play in the decision-making and the precision of the pass and the patience that he demonstrated to let that play unfold and let the best opportunity for a touchdown unfold, that was NFL caliber right there.
It was. And in going back and looking at, you know, breaking down some of the game, I even noticed in the second quarter when Lacy came in for Trent, a play where, you know, to a similar fashion, he rolled out to the right and he drew the linebacker away from Lacy because he threatened that he was going to go over the line of scrimmage, but he knew where he was, and he waited to draw off the linebacker, and then he threw it to Lacy, and Lacy gained about 9 yards or 10 yards on the play. And, you know, it seems like he's getting more and more comfortable doing that, and I think both Lacy and Trent Richardson seem to be very comfortable in taking on the block, taking on the defender, picking up the blitz for, you know, 3/1000ths of a second, and then off they go in the flats, and they're doing a good job of finding some holes.
Yeah, they really are. And then just in terms of almost the symbiosis between, you know, the quarterback and the receiver at different points of the game, I want to highlight another play. Now, we line up in a real strange formation that we've not seen, and we can certainly talk about the formation. But when McCarron rolled out to the right to score that rushing touchdown, he rolled out to pass, and he rolled out to pass to the tight end. And the tight end was right at the doorway of the end zone, sort of the front of the end zone. And the tight end could tell, look, McCarron's not going to be able to get me the ball. The safety's right here. He's going to run. And so the tight end continued to hold up his arm like he was going to get the ball and went to the back of the end zone and really forced the safety to make the decision. Do I get burned by tossing it over my head, or do I got to go try to defend the running quarterback and hoping that I can get to him before he throws the ball? And the safety stuck with the receiver, which gave just the cushion right at the front of the end zone that McCarron needed to get in. I thought that was impressive by the tight end to force the safety to make a decision by going further, deeper into the end zone.
That was. That's a good football IQ play because he kind of put him in no man's land.
Right, right. It's a two-man ball game there, and he's got to choose, you know, which way do I not want to get burned.
Hey, what jumped out on you on defense, you know, as far as individual performance or just the flow of the game or schematically what we did?
Well, punishing, you know, again, is the word that comes to mind. You know, Tennessee, you know, ran the ball a lot more, you know, 92 yards, 32 carries, but they only averaged 2.8 a carry. You know, they only scored 6 points on the ball game.
They had pretty good success early, though, more so than I think either you or I thought they were going to.
Well, and they did, and they ran the ball up the middle. But, you know, again, you kind of step back. They were 2 of 14 on the ball game on third down conversions, and they came into the game, you know, granted his stats padded by non-SEC competition, but, you know, that factors into the math, and every team in the league has done that. Tennessee came into the game leading the SEC in third down conversions, and we hold them for 2 of 14 for the game. I just look at it as a dominating performance.
It was, and to show you how much Saban, you know, really takes to heart that getting off the field, he knew exactly right after the game what two plays they were able to convert their third downs. He knew that one had come off of a delay handoff when we were obviously in a dime and we had dropped 8 into coverage. And he knew the other one came off of a zone coverage in the first half as well. And it was interesting that he also said at halftime that he told Kirby that we've got to get more aggressive here and let these guys fly to the ball more. And so to your point, he knew exactly when those two conversions happened and what plays they happened on. So that shows you how much he focuses on that.
And what's interesting is, you know, you think 2 of 14, well, maybe there was a 3rd-and-1 or something in there that they kind of snuck in. Well, actually, on the 3rd-and-1s and the 3rd-and-shorts, we definitely kept them out. And what really stands out about the two that they converted is the draw play was a 14-yard play. And when we were in the zone defense, that was a 10-yard play. And so you got to love Nico Johnson, who comes out and says, you know, really, I don't think we played well on third down because the 2 third downs that they got were long and really offensive third downs. They weren't 3rd-and-1 gimmies.
Isn't that funny, though, that, I mean, you only converted 2 out of 14. That just shows you the mindset. Like we talked about Trent a few weeks ago after a big performance. You know, he was talking about he had missed a couple blitz pickups. I just think it's so interesting how he is instilling this sense of perfection in these players and just becoming students of the game. And I'd be curious how many guys are in the film room at any given time. And it's part of your intro on the podcast, you know, focus on the little things. And oh my gosh, how many teams would be worried about the little things when they had stopped them 12 out of 14 times?
No, exactly. That's exactly right. And, you know, we go on to hold them to no third down conversions in the second half. And so, you know, the adjustments were certainly made at half, and they were certainly effective.
And talking about the defense again, before we talk about the fake play that occurred, what do you think about Dooley? I mean, he kind of, and what I mean by that is that he kind of was going for broke in that first half. I mean, to start the game on his first two possessions, he goes for it on fourth and four at our 35 and fourth and three at our 35. I just thought that was interesting that both times he tries to take a shot at it.
Well, I think he has to, and I think that, you know, he knows that he has to. He knows that he's outmanned, and, you know, they were actually – Tennessee was 2 of 14 on third down conversions, but they were 2 of 3 on fourth down conversions. And, in fact, the two field goals that they scored came on plays that happened after they converted on a fourth down. And so you start to look at, you know, in terms of a dominating performance and really just a coach's dream where you can be very pleased with the way they played – but there's things that you can pick on for improvement. You know, the two third down conversions were long third downs, and so those are things that you can really get upset about. And then the two field goals they scored came on fourth down conversions, and so you can really harp on your defense about giving up fourth down conversions. And so you think, man, those are four plays that we could have just completely shut them out and really suffocated them. And so, guys, that's that perfection. Those are the little things that we need to work on.
It is. And, you know, looking at the stats, I was shocked after the game when I heard that they only, I mean, I remember in the first quarter, they had 37 yards halfway through the first quarter. And Eli was commenting that we were only averaging giving up 38 yards a game, and they were already about to eclipse that. Well, then in the second half, they had no first downs, as I think you alluded to, but only 40 total yards in the whole second half. And only 10 passing yards out of that 40 yards. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's just a dominating, punishing performance that we put on them.
What did you think about the play of Dante?
Wrecking crew. That's the note that I have. I mean, you know, they talk about in basketball, you know, he was a stat sheet stuffer. When he had 8 tackles, he had a sack, and he had an interception, he had 2 pass breakups, he had 3 quarterback hurries. I think that, you know, Dante's from Tennessee, and I think they put a whooping on sort of his home state team. And if there's any question about, you know, his health or him being a step slower or whatever, and we've talked about that a little bit, that may well be one of the best games that we've seen Hightower play.
That's what I was about to ask you. I think that is the best game he has played since his injury, for sure.
Yeah, definitely since his injury. I mean, he had a couple of good games kind of running tandem with Rowe, and so I don't have all those stats and all those numbers in front of
right.
me, so I don't know if I want to call it definitively his best, but it's on the short list.
He definitely seemed to be playing at a different level for sure. Anything else that jumped out at you on defense?
I'm going to say what stood out to me was C.J. Mosley. And more than anything, because we've gone into great detail about what he brings to the defense, I want to underscore, is that, you know, he was a co-leader on the team in tackles, got a lot of reps. And so he may not be 100%. You know, kind of in all reality, I don't know if there's anyone on the team at this point in the season, 8 games in, that's 100%. But after missing a game, missing part of 2 games with injury, he seems ready to come back and play the rest of the season. And to me, that's almost a sigh of relief. And we've gone into great detail about what he brings to the defense. But we have all of that back in our repertoire now.
Well, it is an interesting correlation. You and I noticed during the game when Tennessee was calling one of their early timeouts to decide what to do on fourth down, that Kirby Smart was motioning C.J. Mosley over to the sideline. And of everybody on the defense, he was the only one that came over there because he was, in essence, you know, being the coach of the defense. And so as we just talked about Dante and how he seemed to really be playing in a different gear, you know, coaches are always talking about, you know, players early on, they don't have the playbook down, and so they're worried about all that. But once they get the playbook down, they can just fly to the ball. Well, it's interesting that CJ went out early in the Florida game, and Dante has had to take on that responsibility that he was kind of glad to not be messing with for 2 weeks. And it's almost like he came into this game saying, hot damn, I don't have to run the defense. I can just go after the quarterback.
Yeah, it does seem like, you know, Hightower, and not only has he done that, you know, this year when Mosley was out, but he's done it, you know, last year. And that's kind of been his thing, kind of taking over the middle linebacker spot and his experience on the defense. And so it did free him up to not have to do that. But there's sort of a parallel beauty to it that says, hey, C.J. Mosley is the guy that's going to be doing this for the next couple of years. And so while Hightower is still on the defense, let's give Mosley some chance at it as well.
Oh, no, it bodes very well for us that Dante is not taking on that responsibility. Anything else on the defense that jumped out at you as far as schematically and kind of how we approach the game? We seem to be playing a pretty decent percentage of both the nickel as well as a lot of the four linebacker sets.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing that surprises me. We see Jarrell and Nico on the field a lot, and I'm not mad at necessarily.
A lot more than before, right?
Yeah, and I'm not mad at either of those guys. But, you know, we went through all of last season where we said the nickel was our base defense, and we've seen so much of the nickel this year, and we easily go into a dime from there. We're seeing us go a lot the other way with really our base, what Coach calls our base personnel. You know, one thing that kind of jumped out at me, and I kind of joked when they threw the ball over the middle and had a nice play, and I kind of joked, you know, that play right there is why base personnel is not necessarily our base defense, because I think if Mosley's out there patrolling the middle, they don't throw the ball in that situation. So I think there was some opportunistic play calling on their side. They kind of know what they can and can't do based on the personnel that's out there.
They do. And as far as the schematics go, I think we dialed up a bunch of blitzes there in the second half. We showed a lot more of those than I expected us to show.
Yeah, we really got after them in the second half. And, you know, I don't know if it's that we didn't want to show it or we just wanted to be extra aggressive, you know, all of those things. You know, we would be a tough team to prepare for, I think, on both sides of the ball now, because we have so much and just the versatility. And we talk about being multiple and, you know, we've spent a lot of time on that in previous episodes. I mean, we have the capability to be multiple on both sides of the ball. A lot of versatility there. I just, you know, I'm biased and, you know, obviously that's the case. But, damn, we've just got to be a tough team to prep.
We are. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how LSU comes at this as far as, you know, them playing so much of that power eye. And we can talk about this later in the podcast. But this will be an interesting test because this will be kind of power versus power.
Yeah, it will. We'll call try on special teams.
You know, first of all, it would have to be the play of our kickoffs and the fact that Cade Foster was able to come back from that concussion. I don't know what the severity of it was, but he had his best game kicking the ball off. And I noticed, you know, I think every time but one, it was all the 4 and 5 yard line. And then unfortunately for him, the one time it went to the, you know, right inside the goal line, you know, I think the guy could have run it out, and he kind of hesitated and took a knee, and gosh, I bet you 80,000 fans applauded whenever he had his second touchback of the season.
Yeah, there's a little bit of sarcasm there. That was one of the loudest cheers of the night, and I know I certainly contributed to it. When the guy caught the ball, you know, he definitely could have come out. He had room to run, and when he took a knee, his, you know, there was almost even no room for him to take a knee and not come out of the end zone, but you know, he was just right there at the very first step within the end zone, and he took the knee, and there was a lot of sarcastic cheering there.
Hey, I read one funny thing about the stat line on that. Somebody even commented that the other great stat was that Cade Foster finished the game with no tackles.
You don't want your kicker, you know, contributing on many tackles. That's a good line. I like that because he has made quite a number of tackles this season.
Hey, what did you think about something else that jumped out at me was the play of the punt return game? And I'm going to let you touch on this because you talked about this during the game, but just talk a little bit about Marquise Mays, and he fumbled those first couple punts. And then on the third punt, he had the wherewithal to let that one go. But we could have had a couple turnovers early in that game.
Yeah, we really could. Mays was mostly held in check. You know, he had 33 yards on the game, and he did bobble a couple. You know, one of the things that, you know, that stood out is their punter was a left-footed punter. And so just the spin on the ball is different. It's like a left-handed quarterback, you know, just the spin on the ball. You don't think about it, you know, necessarily and who's necessarily watching the foot that the punter's kicking with. But, you know, I think that that contributed to, you know, Mays maybe feeling a little uneasy with some of those balls, just that the spin was different and he struggled with them. But he didn't lose possession. He didn't lose a ball. He was just pedestrian in what he delivered in terms of return yards.
Well, and like you said, you know, you have scout teams to prepare for stuff. How are you going to prepare Mays for a left-footed punter if you don't have one, if you're the opposing team? You really can't.
Yeah, you know, that's true. And I don't know if you find a walk-on, you know, soccer guy that can do it, or if you use a jugs machine and you can spin it the other way. I don't know mechanically how, but
right.
It's one of those things that just is inherently tough to prep for.
Hey, what did you think about, since we're talking about special teams, the fake punt? Interestingly enough, that was also a 4th-and-4 play call, but this time they were at their 47-yard line. Dre obviously peeled away pretty quickly and, you know, didn't stay up there. What did you think about, you know, it seemed like we were lined up to prepare for that.
Yeah, that's what annoys me the most about that, is that we were in a punt safe. And so instead of everyone lined up to try to block the punt or, you know, up at the line, you know, you think of 10 guys on the line trying to block the punt, and then you get your return man back. We were in a punt safety, and so you take, you know, 4 guys that kind of line up behind the line. Kind of looks like more of a base set because you have the down linemen, and then you have what looks like an umbrella of linebackers. And, you know, they weren't necessarily linebackers. You know, Dre's a corner was one of the guys. And Dre just peeled off early, like you said, to the position to block. And, you know, and they connect just right there. And so it's frustrating to know that, hey, we called that. We called that. We said watch for the fake, and then we just didn't execute correctly. Otherwise, we would have prevented them from getting that 4th down conversion and subsequently one of the field goals.
Right. One other thing that just to touch on for a second in case people missed it, kind of jumping back to defense for a second since you're talking about missed opportunities. I bet you the JUCO transfer, Quentin Dial, will have a little practice on falling on a fumble this week in practice.
Yeah, he went to kneel down and pick that thing up. And I think as soon as, you know, if you watch it, it happened so quickly. As soon as he goes to kind of kneel down, then he goes to go, you know, to fall on it. And I think he realized, oh, shit, I shouldn't have done that. I should have just fallen on it. Now, he had a good game, and he performed well and all of those things. But they're on the ground.
Yeah, and I just bring it up because against LSU, you're probably not going to have a whole lot of opportunities, and you got to kind of take them when you can.
Yeah, you fall on that ball wherever it is on the field because you'd rather it be yours than theirs.
What about mini game balls? Who do you have on offense?
Well, I've got 2 on offense, and I kind of hate to do that. I was going to let you go first, and maybe you'd pick off one of these guys.
I'll be happy to go first if you want me to.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Mine's kind of obvious because I've already talked about it early in the call, but, you know, it has to be Darius Hanks. He's not a, you know, it's not a mega game ball, and it's probably not a mini game ball. It was probably somewhere in between, but I think his ability, just those 3 catches that he made, it's kind of like I like Brandon Gibson last week. And, oh, by the way, you know, we got to give a shout-out to our intern, Brad, for doing that research on Gibson and kind of confirming that was his first touchdown of his career at Alabama. But, you know, going back to Darius Hanks for a moment, you know, that's doing the little things. You only had 3 balls thrown your way, and they were really – they weren't close. I mean, they weren't horrible passes, but A.J. just gets so juiced up when those guys are wide open. And for him to catch those balls and convert those 3rd downs and keep those drives alive, you know, we know he's a great blocker, but just those catches were really just some of the best catches we've had this year.
You have an intern?
We both do, man. He just works for free right now just because we can't pay him.
All right. Cool.
What did you think about Darius Hanks? What did you think about those catches?
Oh, no, they were spectacular catches. I mean, he had to go out for all of them. They were away from his body. He had to leap and reach for all of them. He had a I want the ball mentality, which is always impressive, but catch the ball, bring it into the body, not lose it, you know, when you fall. You know, that's definitely impressive. They were all significant catches. A couple of them went for 1st downs. Of the 2 guys that I have down for offensive game balls, Darius Hanks was certainly one of them.
Okay.
My offensive game ball, then, because that's a right-sized, you actually got that one right. The other game ball that I want to give on offense really is a mini game ball, and I want to give it to Alfred McCullough. He came in, you know, a senior that was going to get an opportunity to try to compete for a couple of positions, has not won those positions, but he came in and appeared not to miss a beat. And so he stepped in for Steen, didn't miss a beat. I don't think we struggled at all as a result of him coming in.
No, that's true.
I'm giving the hats off that.
No, that's true. And something else that I think we need to bring up there, because I think our listeners will enjoy this, is that, you know, we've picked on Steen a lot this year, and Steen is definitely improving.
Oh, without question.
But I think Steen has shown an ability to be a little bit outmanned or outmuscled or out-physicaled by a bigger defensive tackle. And so, you know, McCullough's got a little bit more leverage. You know, he's got a wider stance, and he's a little bigger guy, and he provides a little bit more leverage. And I think he was able to keep the front of the pocket a little cleaner for AJ in this game than maybe AJ's had in previous games.
He definitely was. McCullough has a lower center of gravity, and he's a bit heavier. You know, he's able to, you know, when he sinks his hips to block and pass block, you know, he's got a little more oomph, I think, to him. I don't think that he brings everything the team does, or he would be the starter. I think he brings something a little different. And, you know, we've seen situations before where we have a single lineman go out and the line just kind of crumbles. McCullough stepped in, and, you know, you wouldn't have, if you didn't know, you wouldn't have known.
No, that's true. That's true.
Well, Tom, next week we got a bye. What are you looking for in the bye week?
Well, unfortunately, you know, with the latest news, you know, we're going to have some additional preparation for the versatility of the offensive line. You know, I think, you know, with the news about Cyrus being gone for the year, and depending on how Steen can come back, you know, McCullough's going to have some work at both left tackle and left guard. So it'll be interesting to see how we work on that in practice. But I kind of like Saban's approach of just not really focusing on LSU. It's so funny that Les Miles is such opposite. I mean, he's been talking since yesterday about bring it on, and this is what you play for. And it's such a contrast between the two coaches and how they go into this bye week.
Yeah, they're both really good coaches. I want to be clear on that. They both have different personalities, and that projects in how they do things. One thing that I would want to make clear, and I would be willing to bet a lot of money on this, is that, you know, when Saban talks about not doing necessarily a lot to prepare for LSU, he is talking on the practice field with the players, because he's probably up watching game tape now and making notes and working extra hours with the coaches on how they're going to prep and how they're going to prepare to combat LSU. And so that level of preparation is going on. What they're doing is keeping the clutter out of the heads of the players so they don't just get exhausted with thinking about it for 2 weeks, but don't for a second think that the coaches aren't working on it.
No, that's a good point. And obviously they're not going to put a lot in as far as scheme-wise in this bye week, but, you know, how many days do you think they probably take off this week?
I think they take a couple of days off, but I think, you know, it's the bye week. You know, and you don't want anybody making any stupid decisions, getting in trouble or anything like that. You want to make sure that your players are getting the right rest, getting the right treatment, getting the right recovery. Then you want to make sure that you're self-scouting. What are some tendencies that we have? We look for tendencies in other teams. Well, we need to turn that introspectively in. What are the tendencies that we are putting out there for teams to look at? And so you need to self-scout that. Talk about the coaches prepping for the game. You know, you have to do those things to win the bye week. And I think, you know, on the practice field this week, we're going to just work on what we do. Let's not try to apply it against a particular front or apply it against, you know, what we're going to see offensively. Let's just work on us. And by virtue of us just getting better at being us, that really helps set, you know, refocus the foundation.
Now you've got me fired up. And what do you and I have to do to win the bye week?
I think what we need to do is do some additional prep, focus in on that game. And I think we get together, we do a little bye week podcast where we talk a little bit about how things have progressed this season, maybe a little bit about what opportunities lay ahead. And then we spend a healthy portion of time talking about this matchup with LSU.
Well, that sounds good, man. I got to go and get busy doing that.
Let's see if we can't pull that together. Hey, this has been another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Thanks for listening. Be sure to drop us an email at alabamafootballpodcast.com to be added to our mailing list, and follow us on Twitter at BamaFootballPod. Until next time, roll tide.
Blow the horn. Let's go.
And everything that we do every day, we want to be a champion.
Get your mind right and let's go. Do the little things. Win every day.
It's the someplace they play football.
Everything with an attitude.